Joining me on Beyond the Playlist is Trey Gunn. Trey is a musician, composer, and all-around musical creative inspiration. Trey, how you doing?
I am great.
I am so excited to have you on. I've been looking forward to actually reaching out to you, and then having you say yes was great, because you're one of the people I actually put on a bucket list of people I wanted to talk to when I first started this show back in 2013.
Well, I hope that doesn't mean that you're going to give it up after this.
No, I promise I won't. But it was definitely one of the people I had put on a list. So I appreciate you taking time and chatting with me.
Great.
Well, tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got started in music, because, I mean, I'm sure it's been fairly well documented, but there are going to be those who don't know who you are. So that kind of background information will be helpful.
Well, I started playing music when I was six or seven, piano. Just, you know, I heard people around me playing music. Actually, you know, even if we really go back, my grandfather used to play harmonica and sing and play guitar for me when I was a little kid. But for some reason, when I saw somebody playing the piano, I was like, oh, I want to do that. So I did that for several years, and it's actually never stopped since then. I kind of moved to guitars eventually in the young teenage years, and then kind of electric bass was when things really came into focus for me. This is kind of the early hard rock era. So Zeppelin, Black Sabbath, Blue Oyster Cult, that kind of stuff. But I was also tracking, you know, huge Beatles fan and kind of listening to classical music. There wasn't too much access to world music back then. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of grew and grew and grew until I eventually decided that I wanted to study more. And at the time, there weren't that many options aside from going to college. So that's what I did. I moved from Texas up to Oregon. I went to college there. And while I was studying there, I studied composition because I didn't want to spend my time learning to really be a classical player. I wasn't that good. And it seemed like a waste of energy to really focus that hard. But I still wanted to, you know, at the time it was kind of the punk era, which was the opposite of learn about what you do. But I kind of always thought that, you know, if I was going to be a writer, I wanted to know how grammar worked, and I wanted to learn how to spell, and I wanted to learn about words. And so I just took that approach with music. So that's kind of why I ended up at college. Not sure I'd recommend it nowadays. There's a lot more resources, but at the time there weren't as many options. Shall I keep going?
No, you're doing fine. This is all the relevant stuff. I mean, I will tell you, since you stopped, I played harmonica professionally in college, and it was funny. I tried piano and I just didn't have the discipline for it. And then I tried guitar, and for whatever reason, I just couldn't get first couple chords really easy. The D and the F chord, no, F chord, kind of mm-hmm. just that where you have to put your pinky down in a weird place.
Yeah.
I was out. And right. I'm like, if that's what we have to do, I don't think I can do that. And so I played harmonica, you know, through college and high school and even post-college.
That is not an easy instrument either. I'll give you that.
So it was a ton of fun to play. And I was playing, you know, everything from, you know, blues and country and, you know, rock and roll, and ran through distortion pedals and phasers and all kinds of, you know, weird effects to make it, you know, sound different and to have some fun with it on my own. And I had a great time with it. It's a fun instrument to have.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and it's a lot easier to carry around in the world than my rig.
And we'll get to your rig here in a little bit. Or what was the name of your first band?
You mean like when I was 14?
Yeah.
Regent. King Lords of Rock and Roll.
And what were you guys playing?
We played a lot of cover tunes, and we had a couple of original songs. It was kind of we played a lot of Zeppelin and Rolling Stones and Blue Oyster Cult and early Aerosmith and that kind of stuff. I don't know if we did play any Beatles or not. And then we had kind of some original stuff that was kind of funk but heavier, rocky. Something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
When did you decide, or when did it kind of come upon you as the idea that you're going to do music as a career, and this was going to be what you did for work?
I suppose when I was about 19, I realized, you know, a lot of the friends that I had that I was playing with at the time, I realized that my commitment was a lot bigger than everybody else's. And I think that's when I was like, okay, well, look, I can't be leaning towards, I can't be, you know, leaning to towards how my friends are doing and how they're thinking about it. I'm going to go further than that. And that's kind of where the trajectory went, you know. But to be honest, there's this funny thing about being a professional that gets mixed in with being an artist. And a lot of people don't even see a distinction. But it's quite a different, trajectory, and it's quite a different way of thinking about it.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a very different mindset, because
you can blend them together. You can run them separate. You can run one or the other, and you can also have them unconsciously folded into one another where they don't really support each other. You're kind of stuck with them, overly blended.
Yeah, and it's,
or we don't even realize that they're separate things. So there's this kind of thing of like, you're a musician, and then when you want to become a professional, I'm using big air quotes because I don't even know what that means today. But in my day, you know, you're wanting a level of success. And to be successful used to mean you were a pro. Nowadays, I don't even think we think like that anymore. There's so many great non-pro amazing players, mm-hmm. and so many amazing semi-pro players. In fact, it's quite probable that the most creatively active element, dimension in the music world is in the semi-pro world. It's not in the pro world. And that's a different conversation. But yeah, so probably when I was 19, I realized that I didn't want to follow the level that my friends were going. I wanted to go, you know, at a higher level. So for me, that meant learning more.
And now I know that you ended up picking up tap style instruments, you know, like the war guitar and Chapman stick. When did those enter your orbit, and how did you discover those instruments?
Yeah, so when I was kind of at the end of my academic career, we'll call that, leaving college, is when I first met Robert Fripp, and I went and started studying with him for a couple of years, and then he suggested that even backing up earlier than that, I was originally interested in the Chapman stick many years earlier, probably when I first heard it, which was the Discipline King Crimson record with Tony Levin on stick. And my first interest in the instrument was actually the tuning. I knew that it was tuned in fifths like a cello, and something about that just rung out to me. I was having a hard time with the guitar, not feeling like it was really my voice, that there was a kind of a bluesy sense built into the guitar, and I was kind of wondering about it. And then when I realized, when I heard of this Chapman stick thing that was tuned like a cello, I thought, I wonder if it's the tuning of the guitar that makes it there's always a blues thing there. Didn't buy a stick at the time, couldn't find one, couldn't afford it. They were very obscure instruments at the time. So I went to go study with Robert. That was aside. Now I'm back over here. Went to go study with Robert, and he had just put a tuning on his guitar that was fifths bass. So it was played. It was tuned like a cello, like the Chapman stick. And when I tried that tuning on the guitar, I realized, oh, I'm right. The fourth tuning is what's messed up about the guitar for me. This is the right tuning for me. And I lost interest in the stick for another 3 years until Robert mentioned to me, he's like, hey, why don't you try this thing? I was like, oh, you're so right. So I picked it up, and the first day he actually lent me his. He had an old one from the mid 70s that he didn't play, and it wasn't in great shape, but he lent it to me, and it was enough. Pretty much within the first hour, I realized, oh, this is the instrument. I've been fiddling about on piano and guitar and bass and different drums, and like it all comes together on this instrument. This is the right instrument. So that's when that opened up for me.
Well, you bring up something that I like to talk about, which is how the instrument you're writing on and you're playing on affects what you write and what you play. Yeah. And when you find the thing that kind of helps you express yourself the best way you can, there's something pretty magical that happens. And I don't even know if that's the right word for it, but it's something that intrinsically says, okay, this is what my voice is, and this is how I'll be able to write best what I want to write.
Yeah, I mean, I think of it as a resonance between you and the instrument, you know, which is not unlike, you know, fretting a string or tuning a room full of harmonica players. It's the same. It's just there's just kind of a when you hit a resonance, and it's exactly the same with musical instruments. When a bunch of instruments hit the right resonance together, the all the kind of nodes ring out and the whole thing just rings into a bigger chord. And that's kind of what it was like for me. It was heaven for about 2 or 3 days. And then I realized, oh my gosh, now I saw what you would need to do. I saw what it would be like to actually really be able to play this thing. And then I saw the amount of work involved and I was like, oh my God, is this really what I'm going to do? and the answer was still yes. So I just kind of dug into that work and it's a challenging instrument and there's no history to it. It actually, what's interesting about the instrument are what I found interesting and we're still discovering a lot. Mm-hmm. I think we can say it's 50 years old now.
I think about 50. Like, yeah, I think about 50 fits it.
You know, even though we can talk about my instrument, which is different than the
and Chavis. We'll move there. That's the next step, I promise.
But the technique is actually pretty radically different from playing a guitar or a bass. And even guitar players and bass players who tap on the instrument, which is the way the instrument is played that we're talking about is normally you fret the strings. You stop the strings on frets with the left hand and then you pluck with the right hand. And that's how you get the energy of the string going. But with these instruments, these tapped instruments, it only takes one finger and you use a kind of a percussive element with the one finger and you tap the string. You strike the string down on the fret and that makes the energy. So you actually have both hands on the fretboard. Even bass players and guitar players that use this technique, they're stuck. Generally, I found they're stuck with a bunch of traps that come from how you play bass and guitar. And this instrument's actually quite different. So we find, you know, in teaching and presenting how to kind of attack the instrument, literally, keyboard players almost have if you have a long history with guitar and bass, you have to unlearn some things. So it was quite a challenge at first. My whole point being there was no history of how to play this thing. If you want to play piano, there's a couple of hundred years of people working out how the body interacts with the instrument. And so, you know, I liked being in the dark, and also it was frustrating.
I have to admit, I started about 10 years ago, and I'm still very not good. And I find myself feeling a little frustrated. But more than anything, I feel like since there is no history, that even my very amateurish bangings and rumblings on it, there is something still that I'm adding to the history just on my own personal level.
Right.
And it might not be something that's going to be ever canonized, but it is something that I'm doing with my own kind of sound experiments while I'm trying to play.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's a maverick instrument. It's not a tradition yet.
And I think that, you know, when you have people like the Blue Man Group using it, and then you have people like King Crimson using it, that run the full spectrum of, you know, creativity and experimentation, where you're dealing with tunings and using a bass string as a bow and, you know, all kinds of stuff. You're really running into people just saying, what can this palette of strings do for me?
Right, right. And that's a totally viable approach. And I've taken that approach. It's a little trickier when you say, If you want to take it up to the next level and say, I want to play as well as a clarinet. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to play with a violinist and hold my own and have all the elements that they have. And that's kind of where I eventually had to deal with, you know, and my buddy Marcus Roediger and I, basically we kind of took the thing to the extreme of like, how do you play it? I went pretty far. Marcus has gone much further than I in terms of putting together practices And as you're saying, I can't remember the word you used a minute ago. Was it codified or something like that?
Maybe.
a bunch of practices that will actually, you know.
Oh, canonized. That's canonized.
Yes. Yeah. Marcus is much further down the road on that. In fact, I kind of lean to his work as far as the canonization of the technique and practices that will get you along much further than just taking it out for a row.
Well, and I think the main thing that I have that separates my situation is I'm not a professional musician. I'm doing this as a hobby and as fun.
Yeah.
And it's something I'm doing to keep my brain healthy as I get older by forcing myself to learn this thing. And if I were a professional musician, I'd have a burning fuse forcing me to get better at it faster.
Right.
Than the bi-weekly, three times a week meanderings I do for an hour or so.
Right.
When I have time, when I'm not taking my kids, you know, across town or doing other things. I think that burning fuse forces you to learn how to do things faster, and it kind of puts a pressure to become better. And I just don't have that right now. And I think that that's the thing that's kind of held me up, is I don't have that burning fuse.
Well, you know, the thing is, you know, we use this word amateur as a lot of times it gets used as a derogatory term. It's actually an incredibly positive term. It means you love the thing and your drive. And that's a beautiful thing. And in fact, pros and semi-pros, they feed off of amateurs much more than everyone realizes, that it's easy for the flame of love to kind of burn out a little bit, especially if you're a pro. It's very hard to keep that going. And bumping into people who are just, they just love the thing is awesome. So there's, you know, one's not above the other.
Yeah.
I do
appreciate that sentiment probably more than, you know,
the thing about this instrument is, in terms of being good for your brain, holy moly, it is so awesome because both your hands are on the fretboard. So it's closer to a piano kind of playing, where you don't have to have two things going on at once, one with each hand. You can have the hands interlocked doing one thing across the hands. And for me, that's the real beauty of the instrument, is how you're taking a musical line and you're playing it across multiple strings with multiple fingers and multiple hands, and kind of integrating the whole body and together for just a single line. That's the purity of the instrument.
Well, and I also like it too, because even if you just lay your hands across it and land on strings, you're making noises that you don't typically hear when you do the exact same thing on a piano or a guitar. Yeah, just because absolutely. The way it's tuned, you're getting unique noises just by how it's laid out. Yeah. And that keeps you interested too, because you're doing things. You might be able to rain notes like your Steve Vai, but you don't have to. In fact, one of my favorite pieces of music is actually very slow and very, you know, thoughtful. Right. That's been performed on a Chapman stick. And I'm fascinated by that piece of music because there's so much to it, and yet there's almost nothing to it.
And what's this piece?
It's by Nick Beggs, and it's called In the Darkness, or The Darkness of Men's Hearts, or The Heart. Yeah, The Darkness of Men's Hearts by Nick Beggs.
I just saw Nick like three or four days ago. He was here in town with Howard Jones.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. Nick's great. I don't know that piece. I'll have to look it up.
Yeah, there's a great performance of him playing it on YouTube. In fact,
Is it a solo piece?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Nick's a great guy and a fun player.
When did you move from Chapman stick to the war, and why?
Not too long after I was playing the stick. So I think I started playing the stick in 1987, was in a couple of groups with Fripp at the time, one with his wife called Sunday All Over the World. I played with the Robert Fripp String Quartet, which was Robert and I and the California Guitar Trio on acoustic guitars. We had a trio, and that was fun because Bert, one of the guys of the California Guitar Trio, Bert Lambs, was a bit of a Bach specialist, and they did a bunch of Bach pieces. So we, as a five piece, we did a giant Bach piece from the Art of the Fugue, Passacaglia, which is great challenge on the stick. And then I did a whole, like, a couple of years shows and records with Robert and David Sylvian on the stick. And, you know, I don't know how much history you know. How much history do you know about me and the stick?
Not a ton. I know you've played. I listened to your talk on your, almost like your TED talk on creativity that you did.
Yeah.
And that's when I decided I needed to chat with you, because that thing, I'll put a link in the show notes for people who haven't seen it, but this conversation about creativity is, it kind of changed the way I think of things. And I appreciate the fact that you put it out there.
Yeah. Well, so I needed to take the instrument further in a bit of a different direction than the stick was going. And I met this guy named Mark Warr, W-A-R-R, who at the time was his gig was, he was the fire in Topanga Canyon down outside of L.A. And he built guitars in his spare time, and which thankfully as a fireman, you have extended spare time. Mm-hmm. And I had a friend named Randy Strom who had one or two of them, and or one of them. And I met him and I saw the thing and I was really curious about it, and eventually talked to Mark about building one for me. And when I put that thing on, just my whole level of playing just kind of shot to another level. It's a little bit like it's still tuned. I still tune it the way I tuned. There's a couple of variations I have on the tuning, but I still tuned it the way that I tuned the stick. And the strings are set up the same way, but it has a guitar body. It's a little bit like a cross with a, like a stick crossed with a super fancy electric bass. Mm-hmm. And that's been what I've played ever since.
What was it about your playing that prompted the move, the change? Was it that you were doing more complex things? Are you playing like a 14 string version of it, or?
No. I started on a 12 string, which was what the stick was, I was playing at the time. And then eventually I decided that was too many strings and I really like economy. plus I'm the guy. Yeah, as successful as you might think I am, I'm still the guy who carries most of my gear around the world. So I'm always looking for a way for things to be smaller.
Yes.
So I kind of whittled myself down to 10 strings. And for a while there, I had Mark make me some 8-string mono instruments. And I thought that would really work for me. And there's some ways that it does, but I was missing something from the 10. So I went to the 10. It's kind of a complicated discussion. And the situation with the stick just wasn't doing what I needed to do. And Mark was just able to deliver on that. And his delivery was ridiculous, because there was a friend of mine, I was living in New York at the time. A friend of mine named Frank Jolliffe, who's since passed on, was one of the early, really great jazz stick players. And he and I kind of at the same time got Mark to build us instruments. And what Mark did was he made two of them, kind of identical instruments, but out of different woods. And he sent them both up to Frank and I. And we tried them out, and Frank picked one and I picked the other. And Mark said, okay, now play them and make me a list of everything you want improved.
Oh, wow.
And so we sat down and we made like a 3-page list, you know, move the fret markers here. Can the pick, you know, can the quarter inch jacks be moved over an inch? Can we make the headstock shorter? Can we make the thing lighter? Can we do this and that? And we had this unbelievable list. And I still have the original instrument. It's enormous. headstock is 14 inches long. It's so big. I mean, I think I played it out once, but
so it's anyway. It's one of those things that you kind of have to, you can actually hide behind it if you have stage fright.
Yeah. So we sent Mark this list, and 2 weeks later, new instruments arrived and everything was nailed.
Wow.
I mean, 2 weeks. So I was like, oh my God, this guy is super serious. And, you know, he listened to us and made what we needed. So at that point, I was completely sold. And that's what I've been playing ever since.
I think the war, I will tell you that when I was in the market to either get a sticker or a war, I actually was leaning toward the war, but I couldn't, for whatever reason, I felt like the stick would be a place for me to start.
Yeah.
And so that's where I landed. And now I own a rail board. And I love the rail board and I love the weight of it. And I love the fact that I can, feels much more robust and durable. Cause
I have never seen one of those in person. Is it lighter?
No, it's heavier than my rosewood was.
Okay.
But I always handled my rosewood like it was very super fragile.
Right.
And because it was wood and I felt like everything was kind of hanging out and I need to be very delicate with it.
Right.
With the rail board, I feel like I can pick it up. I can travel with it if I want to. I don't have to. I feel like it's a little bit more robust and durable.
Well, it's probably not going to break, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's the nice thing. It's that, that's the aluminum cut. So.
Right. Cool.
Talk a little bit about that creativity speech you did, because it really was incredibly insightful about something kind of oblique, this creative process and creativity.
Yes. How can I talk about that? You know, what was funny about that talk was that I wasn't sure what I thought I would know. I was invited by the city of Seattle has a music and film board. Unlike a lot of cities, the city government's decided that we have the film and music industry just in Seattle alone is actually something worth supporting. And what do you call it? It's like it helps make Seattle a tourist destination, mm-hmm. the history and the live music and the all that. So they were holding monthly mixers and the guy in charge of it invited me to come and talk. And I had an idea of what I thought I would talk about. And then at the last minute, I was like, man, I think I should talk about this. And he's like, oh, yeah, go for that. That sounds great. And he said, he kind of coached me a little bit and said, you know, what I want you to do is just make statements, blunt statements that state your opinion without any, I don't know what it is, like not, no hesitation and no defensiveness and no explanation, it basically, and just, you know, just lay it out there. And if it's confrontational, it's confrontational. So I kind of took that and ran. And basically the theme of the talk is original voice. And what does that mean? And how do you pursue that? And how, what does it look like in practice? And what is it, you know, what are the obstacles? And I kind of started from at the beginning. I mean, I won't be able to redo the talk at all.
And like I said, I will put a link to it in the show notes and people can click on it when we're done.
I made a form of it and I made a nice form out of it. And it was a quick talk. You had like 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. That was all you get.
Yep.
I think maybe I went over a couple of minutes. I used kind of a PowerPoint presentation, but it was more amusing than that. And the kind of the way I began it was, you know, there's lots of different ways of being an artist. You don't have to pursue an original voice. In fact, if you're, you know, one way is kind of as a genre artist where you're writing detective novels or you play country western music or various examples, and it's not that you're not original, but it's not the main drive. And in fact, if you really start to pursue originality or innovation as your driving factor, you're not a great genre person. Like, I'm not a great person to have. I mean, I've done a bunch of stuff for music for television and film, but I'm not a great person to hire if you need a certain specific kind of music that's already out there. I just don't emulate other music very well. And so there's kind of a divide where you start pursuing your own voice that you might have to put some constraints on where you let yourself go or something like that. Anyway, that was part of the talk. But basically it was what does it look like to make that trajectory, and how do you do that?
Well, based on that aspect of what you just said, how do you prepare when you're brought in to work with bands like Pucifer and Tool and then switch over to King Crimson and do solo work? What kind of things do you do to get yourself in the mindset so you're ready to work within that framework?
Well, you listed three very, very different frameworks. So it really depends on the context. Like with Pucifer, or I've done a couple of sessions this year so far and several in the fall. When I'm playing on other people's records, I'm there to make their record better. So that's my first aim. Either I want to do it or I don't want to do it. I'm interested, or I think I can add something. It's more like I think I can add something or I don't think I can. And by add something, I don't mean, yeah, I can play rhythm guitar on this or I can put a solo on that. You know, if I really don't like the stuff, it's hard for me to do it because that's silly. I have so much other stuff to do. But saying I like it and then saying, I feel like I could contribute something, that's my aim. And pretty much at that point, I'll do whatever is the right thing to do within reason for my instrument. For example, if sometimes I play bass parts and sometimes I solo, sometimes I do textures that are dripping ambient things that sound like keyboards. Sometimes I do all sorts. I have an extreme palette of sounds I can make, but let's say it's a bass part. If in the process of doing the session that it becomes pretty clear that they should have somebody who plays bass guitar, not my instrument, I just say that, you know, I can emulate a bass guitar up to a certain point. And then if that's really what this song needs, then you need to hire somebody else. But I try to take my angle on it. So that's part of the answer is, you know, I'm going to do whatever the song needs. If it's a session or if it's somebody else's vision that they're already well along in it. I still try to bring my thing to it. I can't help that. You know, I'm always working on some ideas on my own, and I always, the ideal session stuff or the ideal scoring work too, is if I can bring the ideas that I'm currently working on into that in some way. And that's a tricky thing. And I'm usually able to do that to a degree. So it's never just a gig for me. It's always I'm still exploring something. Now there's another kind of session work which is what I usually get called for, which is they need something. Something's not working in the track. They need something. Nobody knows what it is. Okay, let's call Trey. Maybe he knows what, he'll figure it out. And for me, that's kind of the most exciting stuff, because you're not there trying to deliver on something that they already know what they want. You're really going to engage with the music and it discover something that's invisible that just needs to be made visible. So then now you're into, you know, explore, you're an explorer at that point. And for me, that's the most fascinating. And it's possibly where I excel the best. I don't really know. I've done a lot of different sessions, but I think the people who have worked with me that know that element of me, they know, you know, sometimes that's, when it's a good year, that's all I get called for.
Well, it's funny because really you're talking about the constraints of working with an expectation or with a constraint, and then walking in with no expectations and just saying, what do you not hear that you could bring? Yeah. And that kind of freedom for someone who's creative and a bit able to fulfill that role is what they dream of doing. I mean, that's a dream call.
Yeah. 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 And I think, you know, I'm a good call for that because my instrument is unusual. I have an unusual approach. You're not going to get, generally, I mean, in the ideal world, when you call me to do that stuff, you're not going to get something that you could have called anyone else on the planet. That's kind of my aim as an artist, that yeah. I'm going to be able to bring something that, you know, if there were 10 other guys you could call, it's not that interesting to me.
So are you running with MIDI pickups on there as well? So you could even get more crazy.
I have MIDI pickups on my guitar and I don't use them. Yeah, I don't use them. I don't really need them. And I don't need the complexity, you know. And then just back to your earlier question, you know, doing my own stuff and then working with King Crimson, totally different universe. You're completely starting from scratch. And it's not like anything goes, but you know, with Crimson, the idea to a certain degree is that you're writing a new genre with every new piece of music. You're not playing a genre, you know, you're not doing that at all. So it's very laborious writing process. And with Crimson, everybody is responsible for their own parts. Nobody comes in and says, you play this or will you play this? It's just, I'm doing this. What are you going to do? How do we organize it? And with my own writing, it goes with all sorts of different ways. It can be improv based. Right now I'm doing a lot of composing. I'm actually working a lot away from the instrument. I don't really use the instrument for writing that much anymore. I'm getting away and just going with the sounds of the music and the sounds of the notes and how the architecture is organized, completely away from the fretboard.
So is that something where sometimes you find that you've written something that either is difficult to play or impossible to play?
Not impossible. No. I'm very comfortable with adapting an idea. I spend a fair bit of musical exploration time with my ukulele, and I will translate ideas back to the war guitar from the ukulele, and they always have to be adapted. Always. And same from piano. I mean, I'm used to adapting, and I really like the adaption thing. You know, I have this project with my buddy Jerry Murata and other friends called the Security Project, where we're playing Peter Gabriel's music from his first four records. And there's a lot of adaptation to the instruments and changing things around. I love this idea of the notes of the music are in no way sacred at all. Let's feel fine moving the notes around. In fact, let's just move the notes around and see the other ways that this musical idea can be represented.
Well, and that's the thing I've noticed listening through your albums and especially your solo stuff, is that defining a style and defining how you approach, from me trying to explain it to somebody else, is very difficult. It's just to sit down and listen. Yeah. And if you have trouble with this one, let's try that one. And if you have trouble with that one, let's go to this one. Because each one has its own personality and each one has its own, almost like a standing approach to it.
Yes, that is the celebration and the pain from both ends. You know, it's not the way to make a career. Let's put it like that. Being known for doing one or two things is a way to have a good PR and a good marketing campaign. Changing it all the time and always exploring is a virtue of itself.
But there are those that do it. And as far as you're concerned, it seems as if it's translated very well into working with transputting music to picture and doing scores.
Yeah. 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 I like working to picture. It's a whole other kind of working, because at least my approach to it is you almost have to have the music be unfinished in certain ways so that there's room for the picture, so that it will lock into the picture. If you've flushed out the music full bore, for just an auditory experience, there isn't room for what's happening in the picture. So yeah. I kind of like this, trying to figure out what's the skeleton that the visuals can hang on that works.
Well, and also you're working with dialogue too. So if you're writing something that's engrossing musically, you're not leaving room for whatever beats they're trying to hit with their story as a film.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's the big kind of blockbuster movie that I've never done that, but the subtler stuff, you know, the guy who does most of the Coen brother films, his name has escaped me now, Carter Burwell. Mm-hmm. He is brilliant. You might see, especially one of the mid-career or older Coen brothers films, and not even know that there was music.
Yes.
But it's just kind of the smoky flavor around the room. And you would think that is easy. It is not easy. Yeah.
When you are working with, I really enjoy the album you did with Marco Miniman. Oh, yeah. When you were working with him, was there kind of a, let's not have any kind of, what was the approach? Because it felt like you guys were just like, let's not have any rules. Let's just go for it and see what happens.
Are you talking about the Modulator record?
Uh-huh. I am.
Okay, well, you don't know how it was made then.
I don't.
Let me tell you, because it is the most ass-backwards record ever made. That record is Marco. So Marco's an over-the-top drummer. He's not quite he's not from this planet. I don't know. I don't know where Marco gets his abilities and his time and his drive to pursue this. But basically, Marco, I don't know what he does now, but at the time, he basically does this drum solo every morning as a kind of warm up for the day. And so one time he decided to record it, and I think it was recorded in Germany. He recorded his warm up drum solo at 7 a.m. And he said, wow, that's really cool. I wonder if I could get some musicians to write music on top of my drum solo.
I've read about this. I didn't know that. Okay. I've read about this one. Okay.
Marco contacted, I was playing with Marco and this guitar player, Alex Makacek, with Eddie Jobson and this project called UKZ. And Marcos came to me and said, you know, he's got this crazy project. Would I like to do it? You get to make a whole record on top of my 51-minute drum solo. And I was like, no way am I going to do that. Forget that. I'm not interested. And he's like, okay, cool. But it's pretty cool. You know, Alex is going to do one. And I think Mike Keneally is going to do one. I was like, yeah, those guys can do that. There's no way I'm going to, for so many reasons, the amount of work involved and how to even figure out what Marco's doing and all that. So, and like about 6 months later, he came back to me. He's like, get this, you know, it's pretty cool. Mike just gave me his version and Alex has got one. And, you know, I've already done one. And I'm trying to get as many people as possible to do a whole record on top of my drum solo. And I still said, nah, I don't want to do that. Another 6 months later, he's like, well, Alex is almost, you know, working on his. It's like, okay, look, let me hear some of it. So he played me one of his versions of just a little section. Then he played me, I think he played me a Mike Keneally one. Then he played me Alex Makacek's of the same section of drumming, but three different guys had played, put recorded and written different music on top of it. And I was like, oh, okay, I get this. Now, you know what? Let me have a try. I'm going to try. I'll try like the first 3 or 4 minutes. He's like, okay. So he sent me the drum solo and I sat down and recorded something over the first 4 or 5 minutes. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to do it my way. I'm not going to do it Alex's way. I'm not going to do it like Keneally. I'm not going to do it like Marco. I'm not going to do it like anybody. And I don't know if they'll like it or not, because I'm not a fusion player like those guys. And, it was pretty cool what I did. I sent it back to Marco and he was like, oh, that's great. Let's do it. I was like, okay, fine. So the whole record was recorded on top of his drum solo. And the only condition was you can't edit the drums.
Wow.
So you're stuck with what he put down. So I spent, basically it was a 2-year project. I just kind of started tackling sections of it, not in order. You know, I would just pick a section that I liked or a section that I thought would work. And I did the beginning. I did a couple of things in the middle, something in the first third. I worked on the ending, you know, and I got about, like, after about a year, a little over a year, I'd gotten through about maybe 2/3 of the record. And I was pretty happy with that. And then I got in touch, and I had been in touch with Alex a lot. And Alex, I don't know if you know Alex Makacek, but he's an amazing guitar player from Vienna, lives in LA. And he was like, well, what are you doing in, you know, what are you doing at minute 37 to minute 41? I was like, man, I don't know what to do with that section. You know, what is Marco doing? He's like, okay, so look, Marco's, I think he's playing in 9/8. With the kick drums, and then the cymbals are doing 8 over that, and then 7 over that, and then 6 over that, and then 5. And I was like, oh, no wonder it sounds like such a nightmare. And so basically the last 5 minutes of making the record, the last 5 to 10 minutes of music on the record, Alex and I spent like 6 or 8 months often on the phone with each other. What about this? You know, what are you doing here? It's like, I just wrote this and it sounds terrible now. I'm going to scratch it. And so we kind of talked each other through finishing the record. And what was interesting was that parts of the solo, the drumming, everybody had an easy time with, and other parts everybody had a super hard time with. So it was this massive problem solving issue, piece. And everybody solved it differently. You know, Alex had 24 different pieces. I don't know how many, 24 different track listings. Mm-hmm. Of course, the thing is contiguous.
Yeah.
So you can't, you have to have all the pieces, all the bits run together. So for me, it was probably the hardest writing composing challenge I've ever had, because you could be writing from minute 35 to 40 and have something great, and then something starting at minute 42 to 46 that was great, and now you had to sew them together. And when you sewed them together, suddenly the whole architecture of the house would fall apart. So that's the story of Modulator. And in the end, there were at least 7 different records made on top of this whole drum solo, and mine's one of them. Alex's was called 24 Tales. And it's fascinating to listen to even just the first 5 minutes of everyone's put next to each other and see how they solved the issue.
Yeah, I love the experiment idea. I read about this, and I don't remember where or how long ago, but it was when Marco put out one of his solo albums. I was reading back through his website at some of the other things he'd done, and right. I was fascinated by this idea. And now it all kind of comes together. And I enjoyed Modulator. I listened to it from front to back, and it's fantastic. And I didn't realize that was the way it worked. It just felt like, it felt like you guys sat down together and said, okay, no rules, let's go.
Nope. Marco got to do that. All the rest of us had to have lots of, for him, it was the easiest record he's ever made.
Yeah, 6 times.
Yeah.
Well, Trey, why don't you tell everyone where they can find you, follow you, keep up with what you're doing, and listen to more of the incredible music you do.
Yeah. So my website, treygunn.com, nowadays the website doesn't stay as up to date as Facebook and Instagram, which is also Trey Gunn. I have my own record label, which I put out a lot of other musicians' labels on it. It's called 7D Media, and that's 7dmedia.com. A big chunk of my work is actually coaching musicians that kind of grew out of that creativity presentation that you're talking about. And my coaching program is called Original Voice Coaching. And I think the website is originalvoice.coach. And it's something that's I love doing it. It's fascinating. And it's more than teaching. It's usually involving the creative process. And I kind of coach people through their compositions and really whatever they're working on. So what else? I think that's it.
Well, Trey, I really appreciate you taking time out of your probably busy schedule to sit down and chat with me. But this has been great for me. I really appreciate it, taking time.
Great. I'm happy to be here.
For more Beyond the Playlist with Jay Hammond C, you can go to jhammondc.com. You can follow me on Twitter at jhammondc. You can email the show at jhammondc@gmail.com. The theme music is by Magnus Ellegren, featuring Jimmy C and the New York Brass. The cover art is by Phil Rude. You can join the Facebook group for Beyond the Playlist with Jay Hammond C. You can find this and other fine shows streaming at Alpha Geek Radio. If you like what you hear, you can go to iTunes or Stitcher and leave a review. Thank you for listening to Beyond the Playlist with Jay Hammond C.